Welcome to the Center of Everywhere podcast, where we explore stories of rural Minnesotans who are making a difference in their communities. Rural isn't in the middle of nowhere. It is in the center of everywhere.
Hello, and welcome to episode 9 of the Center of Everywhere podcast. I'm Kelly Ash, Research Associate at the Center for Rural Policy and Development, and in this episode, we'll be talking with Dave Unmacht. Dave is the Executive Director of the League of Minnesota Cities, and he'll be sharing his thoughts on the challenges and opportunities facing Minnesota small towns, how uncertainty will be the defining characteristic of the next 5 years, and why getting involved in local government may just be the best thing you ever do in life.
Welcome to the Center of Everywhere podcast. My name is Julie Tesh, and I am the President and CEO of the Center for Rural Policy and Development. We're very excited today to have with us Dave Unmacht, who is the Executive Director for the League of Minnesota Cities. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about the League of Minnesota Cities and also about yourself?
As Julie said, my name is Dave Unmacht. I'm the League of Minnesota Cities Executive Director. I've been in this position for 5 years on August 1st, so just 5 years and a couple months. My background is in local government. I've been in local government in Minnesota for about 35 years or thereabouts. I've worked in city government, county government. I've done some consulting work in local government, and now I work for the League of Minnesota Cities, which is a statewide association of cities. So there are 833 members in the league. We're the largest city-based association in the state. There are several others that are our affiliates. There's a coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, Metropolitan Cities, and then the Minnesota Association of Small Cities. And we work very closely with all of those entities on behalf of our cities in the state. The League's office is in St. Paul. We do a variety of things, Julie. We do advocacy in St. Paul primarily, although we do some work in Washington. It's harder there, obviously. We do communications. We do research. We answer a lot of questions cities have about anything from their budget to HR issues to legal issues. We have a bunch of staff attorneys that provide support and help to our cities. We put on training and conferences. And then finally, we have insurance side of our business. We do property casualty and workers' compensation insurance for our cities. So kind of an all-purpose member-based association here in Minnesota. Just as a coincidental fact, there are 49 municipal leagues in the country, and the only state that doesn't have one is Hawaii, because there aren't enough cities in Hawaii to form a league. So it's a great job. It's a wonderful organization, and I like to work on behalf of all the cities in the state.
Very good. You said there's 833 cities that are members. How many of those do you think are rural cities that you would describe as rural?
So there are actually 853 cities in the state. 20 cities are not members, but they are very small, very, very small. I couldn't even name them candidly. Well, the majority of our cities are going to be in the rural area, because I think we have, I'm just best guess here, you know, roughly 100 cities in the metropolitan area, plus or minus. So that would leave, 700 or 700 plus that are in rural Minnesota. That counts, of course, the entire state outside of the Twin Cities metropolitan area. That would mean, obviously, St. Cloud, Rochester, and Duluth, and so forth would be counted in the rural category. They have their mini metropolitan regions there, obviously, with communities around them. But the majority of our cities, Julie, are under 10,000. In fact, a significant percent of our cities are under 5,000. So both rural and small make up a big bulk of our members.
And I know you have been a gracious host to our organization, to the Center for Rural Policy and Development, in the past months here, allowing us to have a board meeting in your office building in St. Paul when we've been there at the Capitol. So it's great building a relationship and working with your staff. I want to ask you, the country is facing several crisis points right now, and we hear about it all the time in the news, but some are more concentrated in rural areas. From your perspective, what are you seeing out there?
Yeah, it's interesting. This starting this week and going into the next month, several representatives of the league, myself included, my deputy Luke Fisher, some executive committee members, and a few staff members are going to be going out and meeting with our city officials across the state. We have meetings scheduled in all sectors of our state, and we're going to learned firsthand what some of the immediate issues are. We can easily speculate based on what we know and what we hear. Our rural areas and our small cities are struggling. And let me qualify that very carefully to say not everyone is. I mean, they're very different levels of how would you define success in a small city or what their status is. You could have a small city that's doing really well and a neighbor that isn't, or a city of 5,000 that's highly successful and one that's 6,000 that's struggling. So I want to make sure that your listeners know I'm offering some generalizations and not anything unique to one particular community or one particular area, because there's no question they're very distinct in our state, and that's part of the allure and part of the attraction, but also part of the challenge, because not everybody's in the same kind of state. But overall, let's just accept for a moment, not just in Minnesota, but across the country, that our rural areas are challenged. You know, they're challenged. And what are they? Some of the significant challenges that they have are to retaining jobs, keeping students that graduate from high school to stay in their community. You know, if they go off to college, many of them don't come back. How do you find jobs? How do you find economic development? How do you strengthen Main Street? Main Street isn't just the street name and the businesses on that street, but it's economic development and jobs, small manufacturing employment that makes up a lot of what rural Minnesota has. And there's just a lot of circumstances that are challenging our small city leaders in our rural areas that are hard to figure out. There's just no magic elixir or no kind of solution that you can find that will fix everything. It's really difficult. They're very challenging. They've been going on for a long time. And unfortunately, the recent experience of COVID and the pandemic has just exacerbated some of those challenges. And so we're looking forward to going out and listening to our members and our fellow city officials to hear how they're doing, hear more specifically about some of the major concerns they have now, and offer our support and help as best we can.
That sounds great. I'm sure that will be very interesting conversation. Again, like you said, given COVID and given hopefully there will be a bonding bill coming up. I know I live near a very small town and of Waldorf in southern Minnesota. And thinking of infrastructure, the town is tore up, and we're quite happy about it, actually, because that means we're getting a new sewer system and wastewater system. And it's a long time coming. And I know we're one of many very small towns that are facing that. What are you seeing infrastructure wise, before you go out and listen to people, what are you hearing infrastructure wise?
So you mentioned something that's really important, and I knew we'd touch on the legislation and kind of the legislative uncertainty and what's happening there. We certainly can talk about that as much as you'd like, because that's a big issue, especially with no bonding bill this session. You know, as your listeners likely know or may know, the state legislature, the governor and the state legislature, generally speaking, adopt a bonding bill every 2 years. Now, sometimes there's a supplemental bonding bill that may happen on an off year, but typically there's a bonding bill of anywhere between $500 million and $2 billion or somewhere in there, where they invest in the infrastructure of our state. That includes things such as the zoos that we have, that includes our universities all over the state, not just the Minneapolis campus, Duluth, et cetera, et cetera. But, and this is maybe the most important point for your listeners, is it also invests in infrastructure in our small cities, in our rural areas that are so very important. What I mean by that is water lines, sewer lines, streets and roads. The basic foundation of what a city does and the basic foundation that makes up a community is the health and welfare, and infrastructure is part of that. And unfortunately, many of our rural areas and our small cities have aging infrastructure, meaning that the pipes that were put down many, many years ago, decades ago, in fact, and they're wearing out or breaking down. And these communities don't have the ability to fund them on their own. They need help. They need help from the state, federal government, regional entities, whoever they can. And that's really an important consideration. And we hear that all the time, and I've known that for a long time, is that how do we fund and help these cities that need basic improvements, let alone some of the other things they might want to do to make it an attractive place to live? So that's a challenge, and that's a conversation we know we're going to have, and we continue to express that both to our federal delegation and our state delegation, let's provide support and help for the infrastructure. It could be a water tower, it could be anything related to that. So that's so very important. And it's good to hear that your community in Waldorf is doing that, because I think investing in those are really important to the future of our cities.
Mm-hmm. I know that our local legislators over the years have been very helpful, and USDA, and it's taken a long time. It has taken a long time, but it's going to be wonderful because it was beyond, the infrastructure was beyond old. It was Minnesota Pollution Control coming in and saying, you have to fix this or, you know, we're shutting down basically. So we have a mayor right now who is really proactive on trying to get some small businesses to town. And without proper infrastructure, that's not going to happen.
Right. No, that's right. You know, the challenge, of course, is in order to grow, thrive and survive, you have to invest, you have to spend, you have to build, you have to do something. That's the hard part, because where does that money come from? And it only comes from, you know, yourselves, the taxpayers, the citizens. But if you don't do it, you know, you won't survive in the long run, or you won't thrive. Or more importantly, Julie, you won't compete. You know, if you won't compete for what you need to compete for, which is dollars, investments, people, businesses, and so forth, you know, the people make choices about where they want to live and where they want to spend their money and where they want to invest in a business. And the community support, community interest, community willingness, that's all a consideration. So it's just, you know, the chicken and the egg sort of thing. But for what ifs, you know, and that those are the big questions that face rural and small city leaders all over our state, is do we take that risk? And if so, how much, and what may it mean to our community without any easy answers?
Absolutely. You know, I think of our little town. We were incorporated a little over 100 years ago. And I think of maybe back in the 50s, you know, when the infrastructure was really being laid down, the foresight that those people had, that those leaders had. And, you know, we're doing infrastructure now, not necessarily, yes, for ourselves, but more for the future, like you said, having that foresight and thinking about that and not knowing, but without it, you're not going to move forward. So, you know, we're at a time now where citizens have to step up and think about that future.
Well, let's touch on something that would be easily answerable in a question, but here's the future. It's all about technology and broadband and investment and internet. That's so critical.
That's what I was just going to talk about.
So critical. And we support the broadband legislation at the state and the federal level, where our rural communities can get the same level of service that other communities have in metropolitan areas or in other areas. It's very interesting. I certainly don't have a picture of the map in my mind, but I know that if you look at a map of the technology strength, I'll call it, which isn't the technical word, but it's a practical word of where that access is, it's all over the board. It's all over the country, all over the board, right? And so trying to fill those gaps for our small communities is a high priority. And it's just, I call it the future success of the communities. If you don't have technology or your internet speed, you don't stay there. You know, kids can't compete, jobs can't compete. So it's not a matter of, it's not an option, it's a matter of survival. And there's no reason why any one place in any one territory should be different than any place else. It all ought to be the same level of speed and same level of capacity. And of course, the issue is who pays for it and the investment. And if you have a community neighborhood in a suburban city or in a bigger city, let's just take Mankato, for example, you know, the private sector can put that line down and charge people for the access and the use of it and recoup their money. But if you put a line down in the country, and who's paying for that, right? I mean, there's a cost to it. So I've heard people compare it to the electrical grid that was put down in the early 1900s.
Yes.
And should broadband be that same principle? That's a policy question that others are debating. But that's the essence of the future. Mm-hmm. Is, you know, your little city and all those other little cities years ago were serviced by cars and tractors and people driving into town to do business with grain and groceries and lunch, mm-hmm. et cetera. Well, with that slowing up now, and with technology becoming the prominent infrastructure, it just changes the whole dynamic of small cities. And then if they don't have that infrastructure, that even makes it worse for them and it becomes unfair.
Absolutely. You know, I think of it's really being shown during the pandemic, especially with broadband and with internet accessibility. There's haves and have nots, and there's, it's in the metro areas as well. There's pockets that don't have the quote unquote broadband. And the map you were talking about, You know, there's a few maps out there depending upon, you know, what your upload and download speeds are. You know, here I have decent internet. I'm very fortunate today that video is working well. We have a good stream. It's a nice day out. But when there's a snowstorm or a thunderstorm or something, it can be a little questionable. Now, I'm on satellite, and that works best for us out here. But, you know, you go maybe 5 miles to the south, you're in a different county, and they're going to have fiber to their farms. Mm-hmm. And that's just because of investment from private industry, private company. So it is really spotty, but I'm hoping that people working at home more and students having to be at school remotely, that hopefully we can get this figured out and do like a rural electrification in the future.
Are you Blue Earth County?
I am Waseca County. I am right in the corner of in Waseca County. So just south of us is Faribault County.
Yep.
And they're the ones that, depending upon the farm, but yeah, one of our family friends, he's going to have fiber. And I'm like, oh, I'm going to come work over there.
Yeah.
You know, thinking about the pandemic, and we've been talking about issues facing small towns. How do we approach cities facing fiscal issues along with the looming uncertainty and fear of the unknown? Like how do you best advise them right now when you're going to be going out into those towns?
Well, here's that's been on our mind for a long time. This past summer, we hired a person. She was has private sector experience and also has public sector experience. She was the city administrator in Crosby. And she's now, she specializes in financial advice to our members. So she gives, she doesn't sell bonds or, you know, she's not a consultant in that way that you can hire to get significant advice. But she is the point of contact that we have if people have a question about finances or budgets or accounting or anything related to how to operate a city. And she's just started, and the demand for her services have been exceptional, primarily because of the CARES Act funding and the relief for those communities that are eligible to receive the funding dollars. And there's a lot of questions about, you know, what is eligible, what can we use the money for, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the league has stepped up and has an individual that is available to assist small cities for financial advice. So her name is Lisa Sova, S-O-V-A. Lisa Sova. So if any of your listeners want more information, have them reach out to me or have them just call the league office and ask for Lisa Sova. She will, she's really, really good. So that's kind of square one. Let's start with that. You know, the big question for our cities this year, Julie, with respect to your question, is their levy. What do they do for their tax levy this year? What do they do for the salaries, and what do they do for their budget? Cities are all over the board. There are some that are moving ahead as if it's kind of a typical year, and there are others that are being very careful and being very deliberate and being prudent or cautious because they're uncertain about the future of the future finances. So let me give you the one that's looming, and this is the one that your city listeners will understand, and that's local government aid. So our communities, many communities rely on a significant portion of their budget or some portion of their budget on what's called local government aid, which is a distribution from the state. And with the state budget shortfall being as large as it is, I can recall when I was a city and county administrator, late in the fiscal calendar year, the governor unallotted some of our money, and that money we had planned already, that was in our budget. That was really impactful. So cities are worried this year that there could be an unallotment. Now I haven't heard that. I have not been told that, but it's just based on experience. If the state has to balance their budget, all things are on the table, and that could be a significant impact on our communities. So we're tracking that and monitoring that very closely. That's a concern. The other thing that's very interesting, and I don't think you'll find this as a surprise, but our cities are, the financial impact of COVID and the economic uncertainty and the downturn has been very disparate around the state. For example, some cities are doing fine. It hasn't impacted them significantly. They might not have a police department, or, you know, they don't have any of those costs that didn't impact them, or did in an inconsequential way. And others are taking big hits. Just read the paper every day and you'll see cities like Duluth and Bloomington, other cities that rely on sales tax. to support their activities, or building permit growth, and those kinds of things that are economic based, have hurt those cities more proportionally. And so what we're trying to do is understand where those pockets are and how severe they are and how difficult they are. But I'll say this now, or I'll say it again, our cities are resilient. They figure it out. Our local government officials and our community members are smart. They own the challenges they have, and they may be nervous and anxious, but at the end of the day, they'll figure it out. And they'll figure it out what's right for each community because it's different in each place. It might mean you have to delay a project for a year or two. It might mean you have to cut back on a project. The League, for example, our building was built in 1994, and we had a full building remodel plan for this year. We've been working on it for, you know, forever, right? Well, with the pandemic and how it's changed our work, we're only doing two floors. So we took two floors off. So we basically cut it in half. You know, so cities are gonna do that. They may delay the purchase of a fire truck, maybe wait a year, or a squad car, or something like that, just to be careful and be prudent.
Sure, and I like how you said that, excuse me, cities are resilient. You know, most of these towns have been around for a long time. Yep. It's just getting through these times. And that leads me into my next question of thinking into the future. I know right now we're really concerned about getting through 2020 and into 21 with the pandemic, but thinking down the road into the future, what should cities be thinking about in the next 5 years? What are some priorities you think that they should be looking at?
You know, what's interesting, you can answer that question and be very thorough by saying, do what you do best, right? Provide the core public services. If you contract with the sheriff for law enforcement, you know, continue to partner with the sheriff. If you have your own police force, continue to invest in it. Continue to find ways to invest in the infrastructure, jobs, and economic development. The one topic that, Julie, we don't have a lot of time for that is certainly warrants a significant amount of conversation is housing. Housing in Minnesota is a significant challenge. You know, workforce housing, housing for the elderly, you know, all that housing is a big challenge. Focus on if you have jobs or where will people live, and that's a really important conversation. Have a conversation about those, even though you might not be able to do anything about it tomorrow or next week or next month. Put housing on your agenda and say, what are our housing needs? Where are people going to live? If we wanted to bring in a small manufacturer with 5 or 10 people, where are they going to live? Are they going to have to drive 10, 15 miles every day? Do we have a place for them? So you have that core element of what local governments do. Stay true to that and stay focused on that. But here are a couple of things that I'm going to throw in there that might not be on people's minds that are really, really important. I know you're thinking about them, Julie, and that's one is to find the next generation of leaders. I think cities should be looking out to find the next generation of leaders. You and I had a conversation a couple weeks ago about kind of a sad trend we see in a variety of small cities in rural areas is they lack people to run for office, or they can't find people to work, a staff member. You know, they don't have a lot of staff anyway. But if the clerk retires or the public works person retires or the one police officer retires, where do you find someone to replace them? Start having conversations with your community about who's next, who's stepping up. Reach out to the schools, reach out to the chambers or the businesses. And I know oftentimes elected officials get cycled through. You know, well, my dad was the mayor, so it's my turn to be the mayor. You know, my mom was on the council, so now I'm on the council. You know, we know there's some of that. And that will always be because there is a finite number of people. Talk to your schools, reach out to others in your community, those that may not have felt like they've been active or involved. Get them involved. Get them active in the community. Spend some time teaching and learning to them on how they do things and how the city works. The other one I want to share with you, and it's not a surprise, but it's not so obvious. And I would encourage our small city officials to seek to find as many collaborations or partnerships as they can with other agencies and other groups. You can't do it all. There's no way you can do all of the things that you need alone. And there are people willing to help, whether it's an initiative foundation, an economic development coalition, whether it's the county, the USDA, or anybody. I mean, if you're passionate enough and you got a lot of energy, you can find someone who's willing to help you. It may take a while and you may have to be pretty persistent, I'm thinking about that movie Shawshank Redemption when the prisoner wrote hundreds of letters to the state, someone at the state, to get his library built, and he eventually had this outstanding library, if you remember that movie. Well, use the same analogy.
Yes, great movie.
Keep writing letters and keep making phone calls and keep being persistent, and work for, find partnerships. Here's one thing that's interesting is in small communities, not people know everybody, right? You know who people are and you've been grew up with them. And sometimes there's relationships that aren't very strong or they're strained for whatever reason. We're human beings. You know, in order to figure out the future of your community, you may have to put those relationships that behind you and try to figure out how to work with people that may not agree with you or don't necessarily have the same opinion about the future of the community. Reach and find consensus, because it's better to do something than nothing. So, I'm not talking about even political. I'm talking about just people.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Those are some of the things that
I'm glad you mentioned that about not going it alone, because, you know, people are independent. And I think in rural areas, we're especially independent. We're used to having to do that more often, to do things ourselves, and encouraging these cities to reach out and have those partnerships. It's okay to ask for help. You know, that's the only way that we're getting the water project done in Waldorf is they asked for help. It took a long time, you know, but you have to do what's good for the greater good.
Well, sometimes you think that you haven't hurt anybody, or you don't think anybody's there to help, so you kind of give up. You kind of just say, well, it isn't worth it, it's not going to happen, and you kind of move on. And in some cases the answer may be no, but work to find a maybe or a yes and keep pushing on, and eventually you're going to have what you're looking for.
Absolutely. And that leads perfectly into the next question, which is, are cities any better off in 2020 than they were in 2015? I know that can be a jaded question, but given your position and what you've seen in the last 5 years, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I know what you mean in terms of the context of the question, especially in this mid-September day, and we have something looming here in a month and a half. But I'll be fair, and I won't answer in that context at all. I'll do it in a respectful way, because people have differences of opinion on what should happen on election day, and I respect that. I started in 1983, as a city administrator in Belle Plaine. Belle Plaine, although in Scott County, was certainly rural and a small community then. It's still a lot of ag-based support in Belle Plaine, even though it's bigger now and clearly part of the metropolitan area in a geographic way. And when I started, I can recall the challenges of being a city administrator was community involvement, lack of money, more projects than we were able to fund, and a variety of different situations. And if I fast forward now, 35, 36 years, some of those same experiences we live in today. And so I grew up in that world, and I know that world will always be that way. So to help answer your question about that 5-year period, you have to really go back 35 years and fast forward 5 years. We're never going to have enough money. You know, we're always going to be struggling to prioritize what's important to do. We're always going to be looking to ask people for help. So in 2010, 2015, you know, we had that same overlay, if you will. But what's exacerbated the condition of our small cities and our rural areas today is the pandemic. Let's just put it on the table. And right, wrong, or otherwise, we've never faced that before. I've faced several recessions in my career. Some that we thought were big turned out not to be, when we had the one in 2007, 8, 9, 10 timeframe. That was significant. That's something we never faced before. But we came out of that strong. The economy came out of that strong. And we had a strong economy prior to this one. But this is a game changer. You know, so we're in a period of uncertainty, and it can't answer the question in a definitive yes, they're better, or no, they're not better. And to be fair, you have to answer it more on a continuum of where were you, where did you want to go, and what prevented you from getting there? How do you get back to where you wanted to be? when, you know, when there's a vaccine or whatever, right? I mean, I can't predict that, but establish your place, maintain where you're at. Don't go backward. Slow things down if you have to, but be positioned to invest in your community and be ready to go when things become different. People are using the term new normal or normal, and I've heard that my entire career, so I'm not sure I don't even like that phrase, frankly, because everything's different. It always is. We change all the time. So we will have a different set of a different way of life and a different way we're working and doing things in the future when we can look back past the pandemic, but we're not there now. So cities, I think what's biggest, if I may, after a 5-minute answer, the biggest difference between then and now is uncertainty. You know, in 2010, sure. 2015, we were out of the Great Recession and we were growing and doing things. So that level of anxiousness and uncertainty wasn't there. Today they have it. And you put it on top of all the other challenges that our small cities and rural areas have, I think it makes it harder to be a community leader and a civic leader and an elected official, because your challenges are that much more difficult. But they're also more rewarding. There's more opportunities out there. There's also more, maybe greater risk, but greater reward. And so don't view it all as a negative, view it as an opportunity for growth and development. Change the mindset, and you never know how far you can go.
Yeah, changing that narrative. And so we've looked past 5 years, 35 years. Going into the future and changing that mindset and changing that narrative, what do cities need to deliberately do? Maybe in their mindset, whether it's housing, whatever, what do they need to deliberately do in the next 5 years to see some dramatic change for the positive?
Here's what's interesting about that question is the word dramatic, quote unquote. Because if that changes the whole context of the question. If you'd say, what should cities do in the next 5 years? I could rattle off 10 things and people would go, oh boy, he knows what he's talking about, right? I mean, some of it's what we've talked about, some of it might not be. and I do, just because I've been around a long time, but I'm focused on that word dramatic. And that's a game changer of a question. And so as I was thinking about that question, I've already alluded to, some things that cities should do. So I'm going to answer it in a different way. And I'm going to use a foundation of what I said in the question before is I think in order to be dramatic, right? I think you have to come together as a community universally. If your community split, you're going to forever be split and not get things done. That doesn't mean 5-0 votes or everybody holds hands and sings, right? It just talks about coming together to determine a plan for where you want to go. And I don't want to use the word strategic plan because that sounds a little bit heavy and it sounds a little bit too much. But if you get together as a city council in the next 4 months and you sit down and all you talk about is should we spend that $100 for a new, a new auger, that just decide on the auger in 1 second, spend the next hour talking about what's the future of your community. Where do we want this community to go in the next 5 years? And start identifying ideals and visions and things that you think would be really cool, but be honest about it. You're not going to go from 50 people to 500 people in 6 months or 100 people to 1,000 people, but spend time thinking about the future of your community. That's the challenge. That's scary, but it's worth it. The next one is, I think, create an identity. What makes you different than another community down the road that has 50 people or 100 people or 1,000 people or 5,000? Every community has a mission or a slogan or something, right? What makes Waldorf attractive? If I was looking for a rural place to live near the Mankato area because I wanted to work in that area, why would I pick your city? You as a city leader should be able to answer that question without hesitation. Why your city? Why don't I go over to this other city? Pick a city, name another city. Create an identity. So that's the second one. Come together as one. The third one may be a little tried and true, but I think this is really key. Figure out the amount of money it takes to make some fixes to your community, whether it's infrastructure, fire station, or whatever it is. Those capital costs that your community can't do alone, and really work the legislature hard. People are reluctant to do that, or they don't think it's going to get anywhere, or they're not going to get enough. So they kind of say, well, we don't have the time or the effort. I really think that if they come to their legislative delegation and say, we've got a plan, we know where we want to go, we have an identity, we have a strategy, and oh, by the way, we need $1 million or $2 million or whatever the amount might be, please help. Or go to all those funding sources and say, please help. You'd be surprised. You'd be surprised. You know, if you would do none of the preparation and call your legislative delegation or others and say, hey, we just need money because this is broke, the answer might be a scratch in the head. But if you come together and say, here's a 4-page plan for the future of our city, and here's what we need from you, and here's what we're going to invest in ourselves, you'd be surprised at the response you get. So that's what I think people should do for dramatic change. It's hard work. It's sweat equity. It's a lot of anxiousness, but I think it can work.
Yeah, it's not quick work. No. You know, it might take 5, 10, 15, 20 years, but it's work that needs to be done. And you talk about getting in touch with legislators and showing them your plan. You know, that goes to relationship building and letting people know that you're letting your legislative delegation know that you're here and inviting them to town events, inviting them to the school, getting them involved. I think we forget that we just assume that our elected leaders just will show up, where it's like, no, let's invite them. Let's help them realize what we have here. So I think those are really good answers to that dramatic question. And I have one more question. You know, we're trying to find more leaders in rural Minnesota. We're trying to get more people active. What advice do you have for rural residents who are looking to get involved in local government?
It'll be the best thing you ever do in your life. This is the direct and honest answer. You'll lose sleep at night worrying about stuff. You'll be so proud and happy and feel good when you make decisions that are good for your community. And all of the above and everything in between. Some other suggestions. Local government is where you can make the most difference. You can make a difference tomorrow if you're a city staff member or an elected official. You're boots on the ground. That's why I got into this business back when I was in college. I wanted to do local government. I was involved in the Senate, the school Senate and all that kind of stuff. And I thought, well, I want to continue my local government career. Where can I make the biggest difference? And it wasn't at the federal level, or the state level, or regional, it was local government. And that's proven true. And that's still true to this day. That's why people get into this business. You can see the things that you do really quick for the future of your community. That could be simply as fixing a ballpark, right? Or doing something really easy, or putting a fence mm-hmm. up or whatever. You can go, I did that. I was part of that. I feel really good about that. People can see it. It's tangible. Second, you know, deep in your heart, it takes everybody to be involved, especially when you have a finite number of people that you can tap, that you can't avoid it. You can't avoid the, whether you want to be a volunteer or whether you want to be elected or something, pitch in and help out. It takes, you know, you've heard the saying, it takes a village. Well, it takes everybody, whether you want to define it as a village or not, it doesn't matter. It takes everybody to get involved. And I think the next one, that if you're not a city official and you're listening to this podcast, educate yourself on what the issues are. You know, you may know your city council, and you may think that, well, they're making this decision because of this or because of that. But spend some time learning about what the issues are and what the challenges are and how hard it is to do that. You'd be amazed at how much you learn. You'd be amazed at what you get to know about what really happens, whether that's the budget or your capital improvement plan or a zoning ordinance or whatever it is that is going on in your particular community. Learn and understand what the issues are, and you'll be surprised, and maybe you'll pique your interest. And the last one I'll have, it's tied to, it takes everyone to get involved, is volunteer. Mm-hmm. Volunteer for something. Yeah. And I know we have a wonderful spirit in our rural areas. We have, as I said a few moments ago, and you agreed, this resilient nature of, we got this. The League adopted a hashtag, we got this mantra when it came to COVID. Well, our small communities in rural Minnesota should say, we got this. You know, we can do this. We can figure it out. We've come this far. let's take it upon ourselves to take it to the next level in the future. I think those are some of the things. It's a great career. It's a great interest. Learn, understand, volunteer, pitch in, help out. You'd be surprised at how much you learn, how much you know, and how much fun it would be.
I like that. I really like that. We got this. That's fantastic. That's a fantastic mantra. And I think that's what people need to be focusing on. Follow-up question to that. If there are young people out there wanting to get into the career of local government, what did you study in college?
So it's a really super question. I studied public administration. So I was a business political science major. And I got my master's degree in public administration. I'm an Iowa kid, came up from Des Moines. I was born in Dubuque. So I know, Iowa's a rural state, just like Minnesota, with Minnesota's a bigger population, but there are a lot of comparabilities. But here's what's interesting. Not everybody can do that. But local government provides such a unique set of fields. Let me just run real quick. Public works, build things, drive things, plow trucks, drive graders, fix roads. I mean, construction trades is an area that is in local government. Public safety, whether you're an EMT or law enforcement. I know law enforcement's a challenging profession now. There's a lot of questions about it, but we're gonna need more and more law enforcement officers and EMTs and sheriff's deputies going forward forever. And not as many people are going into that field. So it's really a wide open field, and it's a really good career. So I'd encourage people to explore that. Information technology people, finance people, engineers. I mean, if you have a technical or science-based interest, there are jobs that are in water resources. There are jobs in engineering. There are jobs in technology, whether you like the software or the hardware part of it. There's just all kinds of different fields. So if you're interested in local government, spend some time looking at what job postings are out there on the various websites, and you'll get a feel for the type of vacancies that exist and the type of jobs that you can search for. So there's a lot of cool jobs, and even if you don't go through the kind of the administrative route that I did.
That's great. That is great. Is there a specific moment growing up where you decided, I want to go into public administration? Is there a moment that stands out for you?
Yeah, I think, I haven't thought of that in a while. I can't look at one thing, but here's what I do remember about city manager.
Sure.
So I got rejected from my senator. I wanted to go out to Washington like every 20-year-old and work for the senator for a summer in the office, right? And take phone calls and greet constituents. Well, I wasn't active in any party, and I wasn't involved in politics or anything like that when I was young, but I did write my senator, and I found that rejection letter the other day when I was kind of going through old things. And shortly thereafter, here's why that's connected. Shortly thereafter, I was on the student council. So our high school did the Youth in Government Day, and I was a council member, got elected by my classmates to be a council member. So we had a mock council meeting at Dubuque City Hall. And we have two high schools, two public high schools. So we mixed it up together, and there was other kids I didn't know, and there was a mayor, and we got to meet the city manager. The city manager walked in. He was a silver haired, good looking gentleman with this cool suit on. And I looked at him and I go, I'd like to do that. His name was Gil Chavanel, long gone. Right. And I go, I'd like to do that. I want to be him.
That's awesome.
Then I went off to college and graduate school, and I eventually got to be him. Now, here's what's interesting. There's a road in my hometown near my house called Gil Chavanel Road. They actually named it after him because he was kind of a legendary guy. I wrote a column a while back, and I said, one thing that's not likely to happen is a road being named after me. But here's why I enjoy this career, and I had some fun with that.
That's fantastic. Yeah. I always enjoy learning about why people go into their careers or how they fell into it. Many instances, but that one specifically, that's just fantastic.
Yeah,
that is fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Dave. We greatly appreciate having you on the Center of Everywhere podcast. I could talk to you all day and ask you all sorts of questions. And so hopefully you'll be able to come back on the podcast and maybe after things settle down into 2021. But again, we got this. I think that is a great mantra for our cities. And I thank you again for being on the Center of Everywhere podcast.
Well, Julie, two things. One, thank you for allowing me to be on the podcast. Thank you for reaching out to the League of Minnesota Cities. Secondly, thank you for what you do. Rural Minnesota Research is an important agency, and you do good work, and you invest in the future of our small cities and rural Minnesota, and that's so important. And I know sometimes it can be a thankless job, like many jobs are, but keep the faith, keep up the good work, and all the best to you and your colleagues. And I'd be happy to come on anytime down the line. And thanks again.
You've been listening to the Center of Everywhere podcast, where we explore stories of rural Minnesotans who are making a difference in their communities. Rural isn't in the middle of nowhere. It is in the center of everywhere.